Today is Wednesday, June 25th, 2025, at 2:39 in the afternoon. Hi, this is John Williams. This is the Mincing Rascals podcast, the podcast for people who care about Chicago. Listen for us on WGN Radio Saturday nights at 8, and listen for me weekdays on WGN from 10 to 2.
I'm Austin Berg, Executive Director of the Chicago Policy Center and co-founder of Ironlight, a marketing agency working to change the world.
I'm Marge Halperin, award-winning journalist turned communications consultant and community activist, doing what I can to challenge authority.
I'm Eric Zorn, the publisher of the Picayune Sentinel, a fine Substack newsletter, former columnist for the Tribune.
Austin, while you were gone once, Marge said that she's out there not just challenging authority, but trying to change the world. And we duly chastised her for stealing
your...
They
would not let me take your line.
Wait a minute. There can only be one person working on such a small problem as that.
In my defense, challenging authority and changing the world are one and the same now.
Yeah, exactly.
There is a documentary screening coming up on the 1st of July at the Chicago History Museum of a movie called Drop Dead City. And afterwards, Austin is going to host a panel discussion about the movie, if I understand correctly. Austin, tell us about the movie and your role in it.
Yeah, so the movie's called Drop Dead City. It's a documentary about how it's obviously referring to the news headline, Forward to City Drop Dead, which happened in 1975 when New York City was about to go bankrupt. And it's a really, really entertaining documentary and educational about how that happened and sort of the reverberating effects of that on New York City. And there's a lot we can learn about that period, a lot we can learn from that period here in Chicago. So that's what we'll be talking about. And actually, the co-author of The New Chicago Way,
your
Ed Backrack, he was a producer on this film. And it's been doing really well on kind of the festival circuit. It won the Library of Congress Ken Burns Prize. If people want tickets, all the ticket proceeds benefit the Chicago History Museum, which definitely needs help right now because they had some funding cut. So it's at July 1st, 2:30 p.m., like late afternoon screening there. And you can get tickets if you just go to Austin Berg, my ex, formerly known as Twitter account. It's the pinned post right at the top of the page, and you can get tickets there.
I watched the trailer, and it's crazy. I wonder... Is it accurate? Was it really that bad? Accurate's not the fair word. You would tell me, of course it is. But what was New York like at the time?
I think it's hard for people to understand. I mean, my parents lived in New York City in the mid-80s, and even just the stories they would tell about like what Times Square was like when they lived there are kind of really harrowing. But I mean, you see some of the footage from that time, and it looks like a different country. Like just the public state of the streets and public services, like, it's a much, much grittier, different kind of city. And you think of movies, you know, like Escape from New York, and you had all these movies at that time that showed like this really kind of crazy, not quite apocalyptic, but in a really tough spot in many parts of New York City at that point.
Well, it really looked apocalyptic in the trailer with just garbage everywhere. That, I mean, the dominant theme of that trailer was trash in the streets.
Yep. And chaos and strikes and just lack of management. And is it like prescriptive? Does it say, but look, New York is better now, so here's the lesson we can learn?
It's not, the film itself is not so prescriptive, but I think that the story is just really entertaining. I do think it raises a question, though, of like what structural safeguards are in place to prevent cities from going this way? In New York City, actually, which we'll talk about in a little bit, the potential new mayor there, has a lot of these fiscal safeguards in place still today from this crisis that they went through in the 70s that I think are to the city's benefit. And they really had to learn the hard way.
I remember visiting New York in the late 70s, and it was like a scary place. Times Square was frightening. And of course, having been back there, my son lives there now, and it's a totally, totally different feel than what it was back then. So, yeah.
I promote this podcast as the podcast for people who care about Chicago, but I think I'm just going to move to New York City now. The rents won't go up anymore. There will be free transportation, buses and subways, just like the ferry. The rich 1% are going to pay more, but that's not me. The city's going to run some of the grocery stores to give access and lower prices where neither exists. Minimum wage is going to go up to $30 an hour. All of this coming on the news this week that New York Assemblyman Zoran Mamdani beat Andrew Cuomo for the Democratic nomination for mayor. So is this going to be good for New York is one question. And maybe a bigger, more important question for us in Chicago even is, what is this signal for the roots of the Democrat Party nationwide? It was so interesting to me too, guys, because you probably saw the editorial the Tribune ran on Monday warning New Yorkers, don't do it. Don't vote for a snappy socialist. Look what happened to us.
I could do a whole hour podcast. It's one of the most fascinating races I've ever seen at any level of government. One thing to just level set with folks is just thinking about the scale of New York City as a city government is kind of mind-blowing. So the budget for New York City is over $115 billion a year. That's more than twice the state of Illinois' budget just in that city. There's 300,000 employees in New York City. This is a mess. They have the largest police force in America, one of the largest police forces in the world. It is a massive enterprise. And that scale, I would like to contrast with sort of what this victory was. And this isn't to take away from Mamdani in any way. It's just an incredible political achievement. But there's 4.7 million registered voters in New York City. He got about 430,000 or so votes last I checked. So 9.1% of the voters voted for Mamdani, right? It's like Chicago. These are very low turnout, relatively, municipal elections. And you can get some really extreme views, like, you know, slip through the wicket in some of these really low turnout elections. And he was able, it was about turnout, it wasn't about persuasion. And Mamdani was able to just jack up turnout tremendously, especially among white, young, college-educated people in New York City. Cuomo won black precincts overwhelmingly. He won Hispanic precincts by a little bit less. Mamdani won because of white vote and Asian vote. And he is a generationally skilled political communicator. It is the best use of social media I've ever seen in any campaign at any level. And he was up against this entitled, scandal-plagued Democrat establishment opponent in Cuomo. And I think all that was sort of like a perfect storm. So I'll stop there, but I could go on.
He's 34 years old too, right? And really is somewhat of a newcomer to the state assembly. And that was one of Cuomo's campaign points. He said, let's not turn the biggest, most important city in the world over to this guy. I mean, if you don't believe in his principles or the fact that he's a socialist Democrat, he's just not been in the game long enough. And Cuomo was also saying, look, I know Donald Trump. We live in Donald Trump's world. You can't have this guy advocating for us or trying to fight for us. I know the game. I've tangled with Trump before.
You know, my first thought is, nice for the Tribune to, you know, throw more dirty water on Chicago when they, from the beginning, they backed Paul Vallis. They never backed Johnson. We could go into some further complaints that I have about that editorial. But when I hear those quotes that you just shared from Cuomo, I can't think of anything else he could have said that would have more ignited the young voter. Okay, Dad, thanks for letting us know. You can sit down now. You know, I think this is the, you're right that it's a national discussion about the Democratic Party, though, because there are a lot of old, you could call them seasoned, you could call them tired politicians in place, and a lot of new young leaders who are looking to step up. The idea that he knows how to work with Trump implies in a way that he can kowtow to Trump, and I'm pretty sure that's not what New York wants. The right wing has been vicious on social media today. With, you know, Sharia law, now look, you know, who's going to control, we're trying to deport people like him, or there's just a lot of ugly racist crap. The Democratic Party has to have this reckoning about new leadership and can't be afraid of new leadership. But also, it's not a foregone conclusion, because Cuomo has a stake in the ground to run as an independent mm-hmm. in the general, mm-hmm. which
really
him, yeah. Which
is that? I there's
he,
not a
he
sore
hasn't
loser.
Said he's running it, but he could.
There's not a sore loser law in New York, because there certainly is in Illinois that I know of. Yeah. That you can't run in a primary as a Democrat and then say, "Oh, I'm going to run in the general election as an independent." That's forbidden here. I'm surprised to hear that. I'm just wondering, Austin, whether you think that it was a really hot day yesterday in New York, and that some of Cuomo's likely voters might be older people like me who didn't want to go out in the heat, and the younger voters are motivated to get out.
And his election composition, his folks who are voting for Cuomo are going to be like more so election day voters, and they didn't get out. And I think I totally agree with Marge. Cuomo's primary message was about Trump and experience. Mamdani's primary message, which he did not deviate from for months, was affordability. We're going to make it affordable. We're going to make it affordable. He said it 10 billion times. All of his ideas for making it affordable, almost all of them, are bad, but that doesn't matter. He was talking about the issues that people were concerned about. And I don't think it should be underestimated the degree to which large parts of the Democratic base, particularly younger voters, hate the party establishment. And it's very reminiscent of Republicans in 2014, 2015. Mm-hmm. And that is going to be a huge talking. It's going to be a huge narrative over the next year. It also hatred for the party establishment, but also you could just say hatred for capitalism. If you're loaded up with a bunch of student debt and a bunch of NIMBY policies have made it impossible to afford to own something in the place where you live, that's going to generate a lot of antagonism and cynicism and like extreme political views. And I think that's absolutely what we saw.
It's not going to be any better if Cuomo runs as an independent and splits the vote and has a Democrat and Eric Adams and Cuomo. That'll be the final log on the fire.
I don't want to lose track too much of the fact that if Cuomo was a deeply flawed candidate in terms of the Me Too scandal that dogged him and the way he handled COVID. At first, it looked like he was, you know, Mr. Daddy handling COVID really well, but then it turned out that he was fudging some numbers and putting people in nursing homes and putting people at risk, and so all that was hanging over him as well. My guess is that his it just seems to me like if you had had sort of a more palatable mainstream candidate, more mainstream Democrat, more experienced, that might have spelled trouble for Mamdani. But as it is, I agree with Austin that it looks like a sea change.
So there was a dozen candidates running, and then it kind of came down to two or three. The comptroller got the third most votes. Mamdani got, I think, 43, and I think Cuomo got about 36%. I thought that with ranked choice voting, you had to eventually get to 50% plus one.
You could just win outright in the first round by getting over 50%.
And but it says he got 43%.
He didn't,
right, which he didn't. So they'll continue tallying up the votes. But essentially, everybody agrees Mamdani's going to be able to run away with it, given where the rest of the votes lie.
So what they do is they take the lowest ranking candidate, eliminate them, and then take their second place votes and distribute them. So based on who will be eliminated and who their second place votes are expected to be, Cuomo sees the writing on the wall and says it's not going to be
I understand him. How that works, but I guess they haven't actually gone through that whole process with all 400,000 or however many people voted.
That's next week.
I think if there had been a more mainstream, more well-funded Democrat that voters might have gone for. I mean, the polls early on were saying that Cuomo was going to run away with it, that he was way out in front. Mm-hmm, and Mamdani ran, as Austin points out, a very good campaign, a lot of grassroots, you know, and the ranked choice voting, I don't think it's really going to play into this. Obviously, he's going to need some of those second place votes, but Cuomo conceded rather early.
80 minutes in, yeah.
I was surprised. I thought we were going to be waiting several days to find out because, you know, you never know for sure. But he must have been absolutely positive that there was no way he was going to win. Of course, conceding an election doesn't mean that you have to stick by it. It's not a legal thing. So like you could do like Al Gore did in 2000 and concede and then unconcede. But
Al Gore was about to concede, and they ran up to him at the last minute, like on the courthouse steps. They said, no, wait.
I do think I'm in favor of ranked choice voting. I think we need it here. If you have 11 candidates, which we're going to have again and again, there's no other way to sort them out. And that's how we get who rises to the top, not necessarily the best options.
Why is it that these young, charismatic candidates, the Democratic Party needs younger, fresher people and ideas? Why is it, though, that the younger ones on the Democrat side are like this? Couldn't we get a younger candidate who had some more mainstream or moderate views? Does that package always come that way? Is there a 34-year-old who says, you know, we need sensible spending? And
well, I think people are looking for a change. They're not looking for more of the same. They don't, with a younger person parroting the policies that have not succeeded for Democrats, I don't think would win.
Well, speaking of not succeeding, I look at some of these proposals that Mamdani's put out there, free buses, and I love the idea of free buses. I think it'd be a great thing for a metropolitan area to have free public transportation. It would be ungodly expensive to do that, and he's going to rely on Albany to get that money to do things like that. A lot of his other things, you know, a city-run grocery store, I don't know about that. That seems like a wrench, but when you freeze rents, there are all kinds of secondary effects, and I'm sure Austin is much more versed in that than I am. When you do things like freeze rents on landlords, it's not like, oh, that's fine, everyone's going to be just fine. No, it's like you're going to probably hurt the housing market. You're going to there are all kinds of things about these ideas that sound really good. One of the analysis pieces that I read about this election was that it really doesn't matter that Mamdani's ideas are probably not going to go anywhere.
Yeah.
That what matters is that his proposals reflect his values, and that's what people were voting for. They're not really fooled by the idea that, oh, we're going to have frozen rents and free buses, and we're going to have raised the minimum wage to $30. It's not going to happen. And if it did happen, some of it did happen, it would be just disastrous for the city. But it does reflect a certain pro-worker value, a certain socialist value, if that's too strong a word, but certainly a stronger community values that people want to hear. I don't know what that's going to mean when his ideas all run aground the way a lot of Brandon Johnson's ideas have run aground. Brandon Johnson's popularity is still really, really low, and I think a lot of it is because he promised a lot. People like that, but then when you don't come through with your promises, people get disillusioned.
But don't they already have the tightest rent control in the country? Freezing rents kind of surprised me as a suggestion.
There was a quote in the National Politico playbook this morning from a Democratic strategist that speaks to this. And the person said, "It is extremely alarming that the only candidates who genuinely excite our voters are the ones making absolutely insane promises on politically toxic positions, leaving us in the spot of trying to execute on bad policy and losing terribly, or failing to keep our promises and reinforcing the idea that all politics is bull."
Well, there you go. They don't name who it is, but I could guess it's somebody who represents these centrist candidates who, and maybe it is even one of those candidates, because that's something our former mayor would have said. And this is the battle for the Democratic Party. People who believe that, believe we need to just be as Republican as we can without being MAGA. If I can exaggerate slightly, there's a whole faction of voters who don't want that.
I do think, though, that there's a difference, I think, between being close to MAGA and talking about a faction of the party that is most, I would call it, mood affiliated with candidates like Mamdani, which is that it's revolutionary. And I would be very curious to pull on this, but especially in New York City, there was a very concerning amount of people there and nationally in, I would call it, the socialist wing of the Democratic Party that made people like Luigi Mangione like a hero, someone who shot a person in the back of the head. And those are voters, and those people are getting out for socialist candidates. Those are DSA chapters that are doing that kind of information. And I think it's an increasingly dangerous and powerful part of the coalition. And I think we're going to see how that plays out now.
How do you mean dangerous? You mean politically dangerous to the party?
It's a revolutionary mindset that will excuse violence if it's done toward just ends. And that's what we saw with the murder of that healthcare executive most recently.
Well, there may be individuals who support that, but I don't think there's any strong contingent within the Democratic base that would take that position.
The DSA faction in these larger cities absolutely celebrated that as a just act. And there was lots of reporting on how that was, you know, sort of debated within the different chapters. But ultimately, most of them came out for it. And that was the organizing energy for Zoran Mamdani's campaign. I'm not saying everybody who voted for him excuses political violence, but that was the energy, that was the energetic push at
the
start.
Well, he didn't campaign on that. He didn't say.
Of course not. Of course not. No, that's not what I'm arguing. I'm just saying that that's a problem, because if those are the folks that are arising, like are lifting up these candidates in local races that are extremely visible nationally, that's a problem for like the Senate race in Jersey.
No, that's right? The Proud Boys for Donald Trump, and Donald Trump was still able to be president.
I think it's a it's a populist movement. I think it's very, the analogy to Republicans in 1415 is apt for what we're seeing in terms of just projection of establishment.
And is the through line discontent and anger?
Absolutely.
And so you might see someone who is as far to the left as Trump is to the right. I mean, I don't know. I know Trump's where he is on the political spectrum is unclear in some ways, but he's certainly extreme in his way. Do you think someone who is that extreme will rise to the top in 2028?
Absolutely. I think if you look at the results from that campaign, they bear out a lot better for an AOC-type candidate in 2028 for Democrats than a Shapiro-like candidate.
Are you surprised by that? I thought that the lesson we were learning in Chicago, we don't need to be that far to the left, and it would be nice to get younger. The Democrats are looking for younger leadership, but again, I'm going to go back to that point, but does it have to come with all of this baggage attached? Isn't there such a thing as a younger but more moderate politician?
I feel like the baggage is a little overstated here, Austin. You use phrases like anti-capitalist or, you know, supporting the murder of a capitalist leader. I don't want to see the more progressive wing of the Democratic Party painted with quite so broad a brush, please. I just think there are factions within the party who believe those things, but I don't think that there's leadership nationally coming from quite such an extreme, and I don't think that everyone who voted for Brandon Johnson or Mamdani wants that extreme of a result. There are various pieces that come together in a voting block, and a move to the left doesn't mean fire in the streets, which is.
I don't think the Democratic Party broadly is in favor of murdering people. What I'm saying is that this is the anti-capitalist candidate, and they won the Democratic primary in the most progressive, one of the most progressive places in the country. And you're already seeing, like, Chuck Schumer last night and this morning having kind of to do this awkward dance of saying, you know, congratulating, saying he's going to meet with them, but maybe not endorsing them. I do think that we're seeing that kind of energy, and it will be interesting to see what Mamdani does when confronted with that on a national stage.
Yeah.
And I think it will be interesting to see what other Democratic leaders like Schumer say about Mamdani as he gains national spotlight.
Well, isn't one of the lessons of Trumpism that Trump was able to he was able to get a lot of really moderate voters who were unhappy with the direction the Democrats were going, and then but the people on the far right who might not have agreed with him about every single issue. We're going to stay with him anyway because they're Republicans. They feel that way. And I'm wondering if you have somebody like a Brashear or a Shapiro or a Hickenlooper or even a Gavin Newsom or J.B. Pritzker, who I hope we're going to talk about in a few minutes. If you get somebody who is has experience, who is not a firebrand, not a socialist, you're going to have a lack of real enthusiasm on the far left, but the mainstream voters are going to join. I mean, this is the Rahm Emanuel theory of the case, right? Where you're going to have sort of moderate people who are a little bit unhappy with the way the Democratic Party is dealing with trans issues, for instance, or saying that Biden wasn't good enough on immigration. But you're able to bring those people over to the Democratic Party, while the people on the far left have nowhere else to go.
They're not going to vote for where they're going to go.
Of course, having said that, I'll point out that Kamala Harris was supposed to be that candidate. And I think there were a lot of younger voters who didn't turn out, who felt like she was just same old and stale. And they weren't excited by her. So I don't know that my prescription is correct, but certainly that's what the Democratic Party's got to be talking about right now in all of its meetings.
Well, I hope some of those things don't push us back to the center. Trans issues, you know, we could play attraction, distraction with that, but now people are really being hurt by the rhetoric that the right wing has pushed about
trans. Oh, you're pushing that into the attraction category, not distraction
No,
category?
I thought you were going to respond to me with that, so I answered you well, already. But I think, you know, at one point people thought it was a distraction, but it is clearly hurting people.
But it's not an issue that the Democrats need to run on. I mean, they can embrace or support with legislation or whatever, but I wouldn't campaign on that.
No, and I wouldn't compromise on it either, is all I'm saying. Yeah. But I, you know, who emerges, this is the fight we're having. You know, I feel that a candidate like Rahm Emanuel will be seen as Kamala Harris in a male suit and not different enough. He comes out of the Clinton, you know, the Clinton administration and is as traditional a Democrat now as you could get. And people want change. Your question's a good one, John. Who's the one who can bring these factions together? And I hope it's somebody who doesn't do it from the middle.
Well, the one I'm thinking of is gay. So I'm not exactly sure that that's not a problem, too. But let's just talk about J.B. Pritzker. I do want to get to Donald Trump, and I know we've kind of danced around him a little bit. We'll talk about what happened in Iran in a minute. But J.B. Pritzker is announcing that he is going to run again for a third term, yet he'll still be able to run for the presidency.
I think it was an open question for at least a few months of does he try to run for president from the governor's seat or not? But I think he's going to have to now make a very important decision that I think is going to be indicative of like the rest of his governorship if he is able to win a third term. And I wrote about this in the Last Word Substack a couple weeks ago, but State Senator Robert Martwick in Illinois in the waning days of legislative session, in Chicago, he's Northwest Side state senator, passed a pension sweetener bill that would, nobody knows how much it costs, but it ups pension benefits for police and fire in the city of Chicago. City of Chicago has the worst pension debt problem in the country. 7 of the 10 worst funded pensions are in Chicago. Chicago as a city has more pension debt than 43 U.S. states have in pension debt. It's a huge crisis. And the legislature essentially handed Pritzker a decision saying, are you going to make this much worse in the city of Chicago without knowing how much it costs? Or are you going to have to take kind of a little bit of an unpopular stance against organized labor for the benefit of the city at large and not just a couple of small special interests? And that's sitting on his desk, and he could make a decision on that anytime this summer. And I was looking at that decision to say, if he runs as a third term governor and he signs something like that, he then has to wear the jacket for a lot of Chicago's fiscal problems, which are going to be a big topic over the next 2 years, because he's just pouring more costs, more debt onto the city. And if he was deciding not to run for governor and just run for president, maybe he wouldn't have to worry about that so much. But now he will be governor while, you know, assuming he doesn't win the race, but for president, he'll be governor while that the effects of that decision are being felt.
Well, Eric, if J.B. Pritzker runs for president as a sitting governor, what are the strengths that he will campaign on?
I'm going to deal with this in the Picayune Sentinel tomorrow. I wanted to look at the pros and cons. And one of the things that I read was from the Illinois Policy Institute giving Governor Pritzker straight Fs last year in a bunch of different categories. He's going to say that the state's credit rating has been upgraded 9 times during his tenure, that he has protected abortion access, that he's defended the sanctuary policies against Trump, that he has made the state's criminal justice system better by ending cash bail, that he expunged the cannabis-related arrests, that he approved a hike in the minimum wage, and he had a big capital plan. I mean, he has a lot of things he can talk about. The Tribune article that listed those also listed the fact that, you know, his handling of the COVID-19 pandemic has been criticized, that he had problems with the Department of Public Health and their response to the LaSalle Veterans Home scandal. The Department of Employment Security paid out $5 billion in fraudulent jobless benefits. The Illinois Policy Institute pointed out that job growth and GDP growth is anemic, population is not growing, employment is not growing, wages are not growing the way they are in other states. So that's going to be the battle that he's going to have to fight. I'm glad that he's running for re-election, because I think on balance he's been a pretty good governor, certainly compared to the possibly the alternatives that we've had. And I think that he's not going to win the presidency. I just don't think that he's got what it takes to become the next president. So I'm glad that he's going to be governor for the next, 5 years, I guess, because he'll run next year. So that's the case for him, that, as I just laid out. And also, you know, I respect the case against him, too. It'll be a very interesting case. I don't think that his run for reelection is going to be all that interesting, because the Illinois Republican Party is in such disarray that I don't think they're going to put anybody up who's going to really give him any better fight than Bailey that did last time.
Darren Bailey.
But, I don't think he's vulnerable as governor, but as president, it would be a tough thing. I'm really interested in hearing Austin's take on it, because I know his organization has been, or one of his organizations has been highly critical of Pritzker.
Remember, he did spend $350 million of his own money to capture the seat. I don't know how much he'd need to spend to run again as governor. I wonder how much he would spend running for president. He's worth several billion.
I'm actually curious Marge's thoughts on this, but to me, his lane is kind of, I'm the guy who was able to stand on my progressive values while also still doing kind of like the operational work of handling government in a large city. So I'm like the best of both worlds. You get the ideological purity test of like the far left, and also like the operational concerns that more centrist Democrats have. Like, I'm okay with that too. That seems to me like what his message would be to voters nationally. I don't know what you guys think, though.
You're making him sound like the kind of person you said a few minutes ago, we need, John, that we need for to run for president. Mm-hmm. But I agree with Eric that I don't think he can win that race, and I'm relieved to think that he's not going to try. And I think he, exactly as you say, Austin, I think he's been good for our state. The credit rating is climbing back up. He inherited, bankruptcy practically. And while the pension issues still need to be fixed, and he did not apparently put enough muscle behind a transit reform bill that should have passed in this session, there's going to be a lot more work this fall that will be more revealing, I think.
Are you misquoting Austin? I didn't know that Austin said.
I don't think on balance he's been a good governor for Illinois. I think the numbers that Eric cites are the things that I look at in terms of our state growth path.
You said, Jonna, that he's now sounding like the kind of candidate that we could have win the presidency because he appeals to both those factions. Yeah. Of the Democratic Party, which is what Austin did say.
And Austin, if not J.B. Pritzker, then who?
As a Democratic presidential nominee?
No, as governor.
Oh, as governor? I don't know. There hasn't been a lot of good candidates challenging him. I'm very curious who kind of steps up this time. Dan Ugaste has been a name that people have been talking about. He's a state rep, has been exploring a run. Mendrick, right, is the sheriff out in DuPage County who was thinking about running.
You don't Rahm?
Rahm, yeah. I don't think Rahm runs for governor in a lane that he doesn't think he can win, or would be tough to win, which would be very, very tough for him to beat J.B. Pritzker in a Democratic primary in Illinois, much less nationally. Probably harder in Illinois than nationally, actually, for Rahm to win something like that. So I don't think a clear, strong challenger has emerged.
I think Rahm's more likely to run for Senate, if not president.
Marge, you indicated you thought that this was a signal that Pritzker is not going to run for president. I don't see that. I think that he believes that running with the bully pulpit of the governor's office is preferable to running from the gilded pulpit of a billionaire citizen, and that he knows that his viability as a candidate for president will rise and fall on his performance as governor. And he'll probably want another 2 years to try to right some of the ships that we've just been talking about are foundering. So I think that his best chance, which I don't think is a very big chance, but I think his best chance to win the Democratic nomination for presidency is to stay in the governor's office and address some of the shortcomings that Austin and his people have pointed out. And I don't know that he can do that, but I don't think that David Axelrod and Pete Giangreco and those guys were correct in saying that it's too dangerous to be governor and run for president at the same time, because you never know what's going to happen. Well, you don't know what's going to happen when you're president either. And if the public feels like you're afraid to run on your record, you're afraid of being governor because things might happen and you might not look good, that's not a good message, I don't think, for voters. I think they want to see a strong leader, and they want to see someone who's successful, who can defend his record, So I don't think at all that the signal city is not going to run for president.
Well, I maybe wishful thinking tinges my remarks a little, but I do think it is harder to do that as a sitting governor, not only because of vulnerabilities of what may or may not happen here, but also because it's a lot of work to be governor. But I also think sitting here as governor is the best place he can be to really target Trump and Trump's failings.
Well, Donald Trump still has not won a Nobel Peace Prize, probably because he's being racially discriminated against. That's according to his son. Is mad at the media again this week. While the Department of Defense's own intelligence agency has reported that the bombing of nuclear sites in Iran may have only set them back a few months, the president is sticking with the word obliterated, and for clarity, completely obliterated. Has your assessment gone back and forth like, oh no, wait, what did we do? And then what do you know? It looks like it worked. And then, oh wait, they're firing missiles back at us. It's been a big mistake. And maybe this will actually end up working. And that was just the mindset this weekend. I will offer this, that none of us here knows how effective the bombing raids were. And I doubt Marco Rubio or Pete Hegseth know with any certainty either. The pictures we've seen, and this is an administration that loves to show pictures and videos, have been a nothing burger. So you're left with, trust me, from the guy who said he won the 2020 election. Today, Wednesday, what's your assessment of the wisdom of bombing those three sites in Iran?
I guess I trust the assessment that we maybe hampered the Iranian nuclear development by a few months, maybe. And I don't trust Trump saying that it was obliterated. I feel like I was really suckered back, 23 years ago or so, by the claim that there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, and I got behind that. I thought, well, you can't have that going on. You can't have Saddam blocking the inspections, and you got to do something. You can't just sit there and go, well, go ahead, Saddam, you do your thing. It turned out to be a disastrous invasion, disastrous decision. So when I hear Netanyahu saying once again that Iran has almost got a nuclear weapon, which he's been saying, as the Tribune pointed out, for like 25 years. He's been saying, oh, they're about to get the bomb. They're about to get the bomb. We got to do something. So I'm not sure that I trust that. I'm not sure that I trust that it was absolutely necessary. On the other hand, if they can go back and get some sort of a deal or an arrangement with Iran to stop them from getting a nuclear weapon, I don't think anybody around this table or in this country wants Iran to have a nuclear weapon. So if, you know, so I'm still saying I don't know yet if I support this or not. I'm skeptical about it, but I'm willing to wait for the evidence to come in to see whether it was the right move or not.
I think it was just about as smart as Trump's decision to walk away from the deal that Obama negotiated with Iran. And I feel that diplomacy was going to get us to the same place. I think at the time, his complaint of the old Iran deal was that it would only settle it for 15 years.
Right. And some of those points are sunsetting now.
Yeah, 15 years looks pretty good right now, though, when we have nothing. I just think Trump's relationship with Netanyahu and his fascination with more vicious side of what Israel is doing is very troubling to me. I have this picture of him with two telephones, and in one ear he's hearing from Putin trying to protect Iran, and in the other ear he's hearing from Netanyahu trying to obliterate Iran. Neither of those are people that I want our public foreign policy or military policy to be guided by. So the whole thing is troubling. Did it work? I don't know. I'm believing the reports that come from U.S. intelligence, even if Trump doesn't believe them, that says they bought another 3 to 6 months. Is that worth it?
I think I learned, you know, a similar lesson from the Iraq War about being skeptical of intelligence community's assessment or, you know, public statements about how close people are to having nuclear weapons. But I've also learned a lesson in terms of my own emotional roller coaster about this stuff from the tariffs and the Liberation Day tariffs specifically, where I have a very strong conviction that almost all tariffs are really bad and economically harmful, and that the president shouldn't be imposing them unilaterally. And where I find myself screwing up is I will take, my immediate reaction is this is going to plunge us into a recession, right? Because it's really bad. When in fact, I don't know when or how or if it will plunge us into a recession this year. I just know that it is harmful the way in which it was done. And I think of this sort of the same way. And I think Thomas Massie and Ro Khanna have been great exemplars of how to talk about why it's important to have congressional authorization of war and have been really strong out front about it. And Thomas Massie took a principled stand on that and was attacked by Trump immediately back. And Trump said he's going to primary him and all this stuff. I think it's important for people to hold both things in mind. So if you're opposed to the strike, I don't think it's helpful to immediately say, well, this is going to plunge us into World War III, because then it gives sort of folks in Trump's orbit an excuse to say, look, they cried Chicken Little again. Is it World War III today? No, it's not. Looks like Trump was right again. No, we won't know, to Eric and Marge's point, for several months or maybe in a couple of years, like what the effects of this will be. But the important thing is that the executive doesn't have the authority to do this, and should be called out for that.
If you were to go to Congress, it seems like the possibility of a plan like that leaking. Already, we're told that the Iranians had moved their uranium out of some of those sites, that they were fearing this, and maybe Trump's 2 weeks pledge that he always says things are going to happen in 2 weeks. Maybe that was a great big head fake on his part, where he was saying, "Oh, it'll be 2 weeks," and they go, Trump says 2 weeks, it means never." And then, Trump is secretly at the same time saying, "Okay, we're sending him over in 2 days or whatever." I don't know if he had gone to Congress and had debated this on the floor or whatever, that it would have been the element of surprise was important in something like that.
Well, I don't think that's the threshold, though, Eric. There is a requirement to notify Congress, and certainly a precedent. And Schumer says all he was told is we're going to make a move against an adversary, but we're not telling you who or what. Meanwhile, the Republican leadership got a full briefing on what was happening. There was a partisan decision about who to tell and who not to tell. And if that's because they think the leaders chosen by Democrats are untrustworthy, that's not their call to make. That's not up to Trump. These are the elected representatives of Democratic voters, of voters across the state, in the case of the senators, who have chosen these leaders, and they have a role to play, whether Trump likes it or not. And I'm quite alarmed by the idea that they're becoming increasingly partisan in how they run this government.
In my opinion, it mattered less to me that they weren't authorized of a specific military action. I think Eric, to your point, it would be better if we had a system in which our national political culture was one wherein this is part of our posturing on the global stage is, okay, whatever. Trump says you have 60 days to do this. Okay, you haven't done it yet. It's ratcheting up. Now there's actually an authorization from Congress to go to war over this. Who knows when that might happen or not? It's not like they're voting on each bomb that's sent over, right? So the reason to do it is these are major decisions that require some probity and check and public debate before, not before like an individual strike, but before entangling ourselves in a war. So I don't necessarily care that much about and I thought that was actually a strategic error a little bit on Democrats' part, where they were focusing more on like we weren't told about it. And to me, that seems a little bit weak. It's more like we disagree. We didn't. No one authorized this war. I think that, and Ro Khanna was saying that. I don't. Others were not. But I find that to be a stronger message.
But I'm wondering then, on what information is the president relying, excluding Israel? I wonder what we know that is different than what the DIA is saying, or that would at least contradict it or contextualize it. And when the White House press secretary, Carolyn Leavitt, says about its release that it was flat out wrong, and then she slammed the anonymous, quote, low-level loser in the intelligence community, close quotes, who leaked the report's findings to the press. I'm wondering then, are they mad at the report or the leak of the report? I wonder who they're angrier at, right? Somebody in the Defense Department or the media for reporting on what was leaked, because it seems to me like that's all they've got is this report. You can say it's incomplete, but have you guys seen or heard any other evidence that illustrates how completely obliterated the nuclear sites were? I haven't.
You know, along those lines, I find it interesting that Tulsi Gabbard, who said intelligence, the best intelligence she had access to as the National Intelligence Officer, was that they were not close to building a bomb or achieving a bomb at that time.
She walked that back, though.
Well, she walked it back by saying her statement was taken out of context. I don't understand how the context could have been less clear. She didn't pull it back and say, I was wrong. Trump said she was wrong. And I think when you said, where else are they getting their intelligence excluding Israel? I don't know why you'd exclude Israel. There were reports that he had been talking to Netanyahu before his decision was made. And I think he decided Israel knew better. And he rejected that report and everything else that he was getting from American intelligence.
Right, but how effective was the bombing? If it's coming from Israel, they have such a vested interest politically in what message is being released that I don't exactly trust their assessment of it or their reporting of it.
I don't know what Israel's telling him about what it looks like, but as long as he can say it's obliterated until there's a demonstrated, documented proof it's not, he's going to keep saying it. But he plays it day by day, and today he needs people to believe it was obliterated, and they're not going to stop saying that until somebody proves them wrong.
The video on social media, I'm reading from Heather Cox Richardson now, posted at 7:15 the other night, recalled Senator John McCain's 2007 call to bomb, bomb, bomb Iran to the tune of the Beach Boys' Barbaran. Trump's version used McCain's bomb Iran chorus, but was longer and had visual imagery of planes dropping bombs. So imagine the video is planes dropping bombs, but the soundtrack uses the melody of Barbaran to say things like, went to a mosque, gonna throw some rocks, tell the Ayatollah, gonna put it in a box, and oh, Uncle Sam, getting pretty hot, gonna turn Iran into a parking lot. Bomb Iran, bomb, bomb, bomb Iran. The President of the United States released that. Maybe that's the distraction of the day. Marge, I shouldn't fret about that.
Well, from a president who feels the need to have a derogatory, often racist nicknames for anybody who criticizes him, especially other public officials, you know, you can't be surprised by this.
Wanted to ask you guys if you had a chance to listen to the audio that Pete sent you of music that was loaded to a website like Spotify. I believe it's out of France. It's called Deezer, and it hosts music. But a lot of the music, 20,000 files loaded every day, are generated by artificial intelligence. And I was amazed at how good I thought the music sounded. Did you all get a chance to hear that? And what did you think about what you heard?
I listened to the clips that Pete sent over. The quality is stunning. I didn't listen really carefully to the lyrics, but they sounded plausible. I think if you just said, hey, this is a friend of mine who put out a CD, what do you think? I would not have for a second thought it was AI.
How many times do I have to hear that same old story? It's getting boring to me. How do I get you to see? How do you get through the day when you wake after morning? It's so unrewarding to me. How do I get you to see?
Again, I every time we talk about AI, I just have to remind people and remind myself that we are at the dawn of the age of AI, that the capabilities for it to write sophisticated lyrics, sophisticated music is just beginning, just like the video technology is getting increasingly good and increasingly frightening for that reason. Mm-hmm. And it does pose some really interesting philosophical questions about what is art, and if a computer can synthesize all this stuff that's out in the ether and make something that sounds like a song that you like with a voice that you like, is that music, and is it something that is commercially viable? And is it something that we need to stop? And if we decide that we need to stop it, is there any way in the world that we could possibly stop it? I think that the future is that AI is going to be really, really powerful and really present in our lives.
Does it depreciate your appreciation of it to know that it's a computer or it's music? So I don't care if a human did it or not.
Well, none of it was quite my style of music anyway. But I do think it's interesting, Eric, what you said about the lyrics, because I didn't pay a lot of attention the first two, but that sort of country song that was the last one that Pete sent us, those lyrics were trashy. They were cliche bound. There was no real emotion or feeling.
Unlike real country music.
I was just going to say, have you heard any country music lately?
Been a rough couple months, but I'm back on my feet. My songs sound less sad, a little more upbeat. I met someone new, he might be the one. But my mind is telling me to run.
And I love country music, I gotta say, but a lot of the lyrics in popular and country music are cliche and inane. So I'm not even meaningless.
Maybe it fit. But it led me to something I thought I had heard recently about a court ruling, which I did not find in my search now, about the ability of AI to duplicate actual people's voices, which I think is a real threat. And there's only, that I could find, one state that doesn't allow that. It's Tennessee, which passed the acronym of the Elvis Act, that makes your voice and likeness part of your property that can't be taken over or duplicated by anybody else. There was a federal bill that hasn't gone anywhere that sits around in Congress. They're too busy, apparently, doing nothing else constructive to do something like that. But when you put all of this together with that concern, legitimate concern that human being artists have, that their voice can potentially be duplicated and put into one of these songs, I think the threat becomes even more frightening.
I have been thinking about AI and music for a few months, and I was aware of Deezer. I hadn't heard those songs, but I think another interesting development there is Timbaland, the famous hip hop producer. He, I think a couple weeks ago, just announced that he was creating an AI, basically music talent agency, and he created a first just completely AI character, an AI artist that will release songs. And Rick Rubin said something about this recently that I thought was really interesting, where he said, also a famous producer, we care about oftentimes, not always, in my opinion, but oftentimes we care about point of view. And that's like really kind of what we're listening to is where is this person coming from? And AI doesn't have that. However, there's types of music that don't rely on caring about a person's point of view. If you think a lot of like new abstract classical music, it doesn't rely on that, and it can still be interesting. And I think the evolution of technology, there's always been sort of a fear that the more technology is involved in art, that the less authentic it becomes. But then you just think of like what Herbie Hancock was able to do when everybody was like, oh, drum machines are bad because we won't have drummers anymore, and then or synthesizers are bad because they could be programmed to do these like arpeggios that people used to do. And then you see him, like Herbie Hancock, in like a spaceship of technology, just doing all this amazing stuff. And I think that's how ultimately AI is going to be used in art, is it will supplement it. It's not really, what it will replace was replaceable. And it I think is a good thing for like the progress of music, for people to learn how to use it. I think you probably will get a Billboard charting track generated almost entirely by AI within the next, maybe definitely within the next 2 or 3 years, maybe sooner. And it will just go viral on TikTok, and people don't really know the history of where a song comes from anyway on TikTok. They just like the song, and it will have happened to have come from AI.
And it might be that we would not know it came from AI until afterwards when the producer says, hey, surprise, that song that's been on top of the charts for the last 5 weeks, there is no singer named Bob Jones, and there is no band called What's It's, and that you've all been fooled by AI. You know, if all familiar with the Turing test that used to be the computer where you would be able to tell whether when you're conversing with an artificially intelligent thing, you could tell it's a computer because it doesn't respond like a person. The Turing test for music is going to be if you listen to a song and you go, that's not real. That's not, you know, that's fake. That's AI. If you can tell that now, I don't think you'll be able to tell it in a year or 2 years. I think that it will be able to write powerful lyrics. It will be able to write interesting, good melodies, because it's going to go deeply into what an interesting, good melody is. It's going to go deeply into what an impactful lyric is going to be. And this whole question about point of view, it's academic, it's philosophical, but I don't know that you can tell. If a listener can't tell what generated this piece of art, this piece of music, then the question becomes almost meaningless. It's very difficult to tell. I was thinking a little bit about auto-tuning. Remember that when auto-tune became
there's
a thing?
There's an auto-tuning feel to some of these songs.
Late nights, dancing in the moonlight. Bonfires burning, we're feeling all right. Surfboards and palm trees. Everywhere we go, living life in the summer flow.
Yeah, there is. And I also thought about Milli Vanilli. Remember that how everyone was just outraged when it was like 25 years ago when Milli Vanilli put out that Girl, You Know It's True, and it turned out that it wasn't actually the two men who were in Milli Vanilli singing it, but they were just lip-syncing it. And people were like stunned and outraged, and that was the end of Milli Vanilli and everything. And so all these technological advances and fakes are things that I think just people get used to it after a while. And you say, oh, well, that's nice music. But yeah, it was a computer made that music. Okay, fine.
Yeah, but as long as you have the same reaction to it, maybe it doesn't matter. Maybe it's best you don't know if it's just about the music. I thought Austin made an interesting point, though, about the point of view of the artist. Like, what in general am I getting from this? What are they in general saying? And the computer isn't saying anything. But, you know, a similar thing is Mila. I don't know if you guys are familiar with that, but we talked to the guy who came up with this service, and it uses artificial intelligence. A chatbot will call your parents, or they can call, and they can talk to it about anything they want. So if you don't have time to spend with grandma or grandpa, or if there's just not enough services around them, they can call their friend, Mila, and it's a woman's voice, and she'll talk to them about the Cubs or the weather. And if you think about the universe of information that the AI has at its fingertips, or whatever tips it has, it can talk about anything. And if you call it the next day, it'll remember what you said the first day. So as he pointed out, he said, if you like Harry Potter, and we talk about that, and then the next day we talk about birds, the computer might say, oh, remember the scene in Harry Potter where the birds came? And then grandma or grandpa go, yeah, that was so interesting. Thank you for remembering that. And it'll charge you per hour. You get so many credits or units. It's a monthly subscription service. And now you don't have to talk to grandma or grandpa all the time because the computer will. That's happening right now. That's a service that exists.
As a grandparent, I'm not loving that idea.
Wait a minute. But in this scene, you are not the lonely person who has nobody to talk to. You're Marge. You have endless opportunities and resources. My parents don't. My parents will sometimes call and complain, nobody came by today. I'm like, well, I'm sorry I couldn't get over there and I work all day. If the computer called my mom and dad and said, hey, Adolf, that's my dad, tell us about the Air Force in the 1970s. Dad would go. He would roll.
No. Knowing it was a computer that he was talking to?
I'm not. So one of the questions I asked the guy is, do you tell them that it's a computer? He said, we do. And maybe, and when he said that, I said, you know what? I don't think my dad cares. My dad just wants to talk. He doesn't care that you're listening. In fact, no follow-up questions are required. So maybe just dad hearing dad do dad's dance is enough.
The computer's finally going to go. I gotta go. I got another call.
Ding dong. What's that? Hey.
The preservation of these things is really cool. So, like, this was even a year and a half ago. The technology was in this space, but we were working with a group very close with Opal Lee, who's known as the grandmother of Juneteenth. She was one of the like preeminent, most prominent advocates to make Juneteenth a federal holiday. And her personal story is amazing. And she might be like, she's in her late 90s, like at least right now. And she's just an extremely energetic, fascinating woman. And they were going to make a kind of a Juneteenth museum in her town. And we discussed with them what it would cost to do a hologram of Opal, Miss Opal, and have that hologram be trained on hours and hours of interview footage with her. And then folks in the museum could go up and ask her questions about what was the origin of Juneteenth? What was it like growing up? And it would, in real time, talk back to you. And I think that will be a common thing, or it will be a cheap, relatively cheap thing to do with your great-great-grandfather in, you know, a matter. It already is becoming cheap. If we reapproach that same project today, it would be a tenth of the cost of what we were talking about a
year ago.
That's
sort of the reverse of what John's talking about, I guess, because you're preserving actual people for their generations that follow. John, when you talk about that subscription, it's sort of lazy just to pick a subscription like that when they're probably countless people who you could pay, actual human beings who you could pay to do the same function, who need work and will be more empathetic and more giving than a computer, I still believe, could possibly be.
Oh, I hate to see humans being aced out in music and art, in communication with my mom and dad. Like Eric said, what are you going to do about it? But you mentioned the cost. Maybe the human would actually be affordable. Do you guys have any anxiety about the cost of artificial intelligence right now? That, you know, a simple Google search, forget a conversation with grandpa, but just a simple Google search will cost X and an AI search will cost 10X, just in terms of the energy use. Austin just wagged his head again.
It's not misinformation. I think this is an unfairly framed talking point that I'm hearing more and more. And it's this idea that if you use ChatGPT, you're like sucking up all the water. Compare watching an hour of television. An hour of television gives you hundreds and hundreds of GPT queries. And if someone is okay with watching an hour of television, but is like scolding other people for using AI to make them productive, that's, I think, unhelpful. And in the grand scheme of things, I think the use of this technology makes us way more productive per unit of energy. And, you know, you see that in really developed countries, they're actually a lot more environmentally friendly because their processes are more efficient. Wealthier countries are more environmentally friendly for that reason. So the on net, the progress that will be made here in terms of how it can help our environment, I think far, far outweigh the costs. However, we are going to be in this enormous new stage of energy demand in a lot of places for the data centers to train the AI. It's not like each use, but like the training takes a lot of energy. And we're going to see that a lot in Illinois and in states across the country. And the discussion right now is basically, hey, China is building 1,000x more new energy than the United States. And we're stuck behind them because we have just really a lot of red tape to develop any kind of new energy, even if it's renewable.
Okay, but you're saying that when I ask artificial intelligence to tell me how to change the gasket on the washer and then it walks me through it for 5 minutes, that's not burning more carbon.
You shouldn't feel bad about that.
Okay. But the fact that it had to then go to all of the service manuals in the world, that was the big energy suck, right?
Making it training models to do that kind of work better in the future and do all sorts of crazy new stuff, that is taking a lot of energy demand. You know, in the same way that like Google searches, you know, that encouraged more investment for, you know, new kinds of technology because people saw that people were using the service. But I think at the margin, what I don't like is people being scolded for like using AI to do their work better or be curious or like research things or stuff like that. It's not helpful.
Yeah, well, I was just thinking about all the recreational ways, all of the silly, pointless ways that people use it. And if every time you told me that was 10x, then I would go, all right, we need to be a little more disciplined about this. And when was humanity ever disciplined about the environment? But I'm thinking, you know, we can't get out of our own way sometimes. I will take your scolding of my scolding into advisement there, Austin. Thank you.
I would worry more about accuracy. For me, I now, when you Google anything, first thing you get is the AI summary, which can be helpful. But then I always look at the source, which does not always agree with the summary. It's still not a perfect thing. I wouldn't rely 100% on it. I like sources.
Well, some AI disagrees with other AI sources, too.
That's right.
Grok was giving different results.
Well, Grok is being influenced by Musk's own political beliefs.
Certainly,
certainly. He's looking to change some answers.
Think about that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Think about that.
Let's do green light, yellow light, red light. Anything you guys are liking, not liking, or maybe cautioning people about right now?
Well, the book I'm reading now is I'm rereading 1984, which is stressful.
Of course.
And
you are.
So what I'm going to recommend is a walk in the park, specifically Ping Tom Park, which is in Chinatown. If you haven't been there, I think the best way to see it and the best way to get there is to take the water taxi from the Wrigley Building down below at the river. And it's a lovely taxi ride on the river. Then you end up in Chinatown. The park is gorgeous. A lot of riverfront, a lot of places to sit and ponder the world or just read a good book and then go have a meal in Chinatown. It's a great package.
The music, this is a shameless plug, but I don't think I can't remember if I mentioned it on the podcast before, but I have this sort of archival project around African vinyl from the 70s and 80s and honoring the artists who created that music who are pretty undersung. And there's not a lot of body of knowledge about them online. And when I was in France, there's a ton of African music in France. So I bought a ton of stuff in France. And now I'm uploading it to, it's a YouTube channel. It's just called Rare African Vinyl. And some of the videos have no views. It's just full albums of those artists. Some of them have thousands and thousands. It's like a hobby that I like doing. And so the last two, I think I put up two things for my last trip there. And I just think it's great. It's like amazing music. One of the guys' names is Victor Uwefo, who I think is one of the best African musicians of all time and is a very undersung, maybe genius guy. And there's a great record I got of his. And I think it's the best recording of that record that's available to people to hear. So Rare African Vinyl, it's called, on YouTube.
Well, I was going to give a green light to Ron Chernow's Mark Twain biography, but I'm really only about, I mean, it's a huge book. I'm probably only about a third of the way through it. So right now I'm going to give a green light to the WNBA that I've become sort of a fan. I got hooked in a little bit by Caitlin Clark, and now I'm watching Sky games, and I'm recording them on my DVR. I think the games are really, really good, really fun to watch, and the style of play is more relatable to me than what you're seeing in the NBA. You know, obviously that season just ended, but the high flying, incredibly long bombs in the NBA, plus the extremely rough play in the NBA is less relatable to me than the kind of play that they have in the WNBA. And the Sky is a fun team to watch. They're not very good, but they're fun to watch. And the Fever are also a really fun team to watch. And I've just been I'm into the WNBA now.
It's funny you mention that, because my yellow light is Sarah Spain's Good Game podcast. Do you listen to that, Eric? She's taken a couple weeks off. Her next season's about to load, or they're about to start shooting it anyway. But that's a daily podcast about women's sports. I was talking to her today about it. I said, is there enough content for a daily sports podcast just about women's sports? And, you know, I know how that sounds, but I said, I consume mainstream media. And she goes, yeah, there's, fair question. There's a lot, and it's not all Caitlin Clark and Angel Reese. Anyway, it's Good Game with Sarah Spain. I yellow light it because I haven't heard it, but she was talking to us about it today, so I thought I might give it a listen as well. That's the podcast for this week. That's Eric Zorn. That's Marge Halperin. Austin Berg. We're produced by Ben Anderson and Pete Zimmerman. I'm John Williams. We will drop another pod on you next week.
My God, Austin, do you ever sleep? That's the question after this episode.
No.
You have done extensive research on all these things, and now you got a little hobby where you just listen to hours and hours of
that's for fun.
Well, I get that, but sleep is also fun.
Yeah, sleep can be fun.
Well, whatever. here's the inside scoop, Marge. He's artificial intelligence. There is no Austin.
Right. That does help me a ton, though, actually.
Really? You do use it every day?
Every day.
Yeah. And is that why we have more smog then, or was that from Canada? Is that... Okay, guys, I'm done. Talk to you later.
See you. See you. Bye.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNRadio.com.